for that and for the invitation. I'm pleased to be here. I came, with certain things in mind and with an opportunity to talk to you about a few things that are occurring. I think that is really impacting on all First Nations people, but and the educational issues in particular. I want to tell you, and you may or may not have read my bio, but I've been involved in education a good number of years. I've done my studies in education. I do all the B.Ed. In education and social work and a master's in education. But more importantly for me has been my work at the community level. That has been the most important thing. So I haven't necessarily been involved in research and that kind of different level of work. It's been more at community level, what I call the reality and the day-to-day and the politics of it. I've been on band council off and on over the years, been elected and came and went and have sat and continue to sit on a number of First Nations educational committees nationally on critical files. And I'll speak a little bit later about the recent meeting that was held in Kelowna, the First Minister's meeting, and what I think and what impact it's going to have on First Nations people, if any. I should mention right off the bat also that I am now working with the First Nations Education Council in Quebec, which is an organization representing 22 First Nations communities, including, of course, Lestigouche, but not including the Crees or the Niskapi or some of the Montagnais. And the organization has its head office in Wendake, Huron Village, and provides both services and resourcing to communities in a variety of areas of education. And that whole issue of our organization in Quebec becomes important because there's a lot of talk, and again, I'll speak to that, the whole issue of developing in Canada educational systems for First Nations, which doesn't exist right now. There are many critical files occurring nationally. For example, at this time, and some of you may or may not be impacted by it, maybe your relatives or your friends or whatnot may be, and that's the post-secondary program. The post-secondary program right now in Canada, which is a program that's existed since the early 70s, is undergoing a review. And it's the first time that there's been a joint working group review of this program since 1989. It's really, really the first time. And it appears to us that there will be major changes to the program that will have an impact on the levels of funding, who gets funding, how, what, when, and who's going to get supported to achieve those goals. Because as you well know, with large portions of our population living in the urban centers, although in Quebec we still have larger numbers of our people living on reserve, it's, I think, unlike other regions of Canada. Nevertheless, there is an issue there that most parents, most families cannot come to support their children in pursuing post-secondary education, and that the funding support from the federal government is a very important factor. Although at this time in Canada, there's some 10,000 First Nations students who are unable, with the resources they have, to access post-secondary or to complete post-secondary because the funding is just not there. And that's very clear. And there's been a lot of work to try to ensure that the funding would be there. There are about 25,000 First Nation post-secondary students in Canada. The graduation rate still leaves a lot to be desired. The number of students actually getting into the program and successfully completing, there's a lot of work to be done in there. And what that means, and if we use McGill as an example, is that universities, colleges need to become much more welcoming to First Nations students and supportive. And in my work with McGill and the teacher training side of it, often that's been a real huge challenge, because they haven't really been willing and open to listening and developing centers of excellence, allowing the First Nations communities to have control of what's going on. And it's always controlled by the institutions, so First Nations are not involved. The whole issue of education that all First Nations are meeting is sometimes not so much at a post-secondary level, but what's happening in the community, or even young people who are attending the provincial schools. Because as you may or may not know, some communities don't have their own schools, so the kids have to attend the provincial school, and the community often has to pay literally millions of dollars for those students to attend those provincial schools. In Quebec, the tuition rate is about $5,600 for a high school student, about $5,400 per elementary that the community dishes out. And if the community wants any additional services, well, it's got to pay it out themselves. So that, you know, becomes a real problem. But the reality is the graduation rate is atrocious. You may or may not have read that only about 30 to 40% of students, First Nation students, both on or off the reserve, actually complete their high school, compared to about 75 to 80% in mainstream. So there's a major problem. That even with the taking of control by First Nations of our education, due to the lack of resources, due to the lack of support, the success rate just hasn't been there. So the First Nation students who do make it to university are really the elite or the cream of what's coming out of the community. They've been able to pull it together and maintain it. Therefore, it becomes even more important that there be a lot of support for these students to ensure, because they are the role models, the young people can then see, yes, these people can make it. And they are making it, and they've overcome these obstacles. One of the things that we often don't go and check or verify is those individuals that have made it, what is it that they have that allows them to overcome obstacles that the majority of our young people don't seem to be able to overcome? What is it? What works for them? Is it, you know, parental support, family support? Is it their own upbringing? Is it what's occurring in the urban center? Because usually that's where the institutions are found. What is it that allows them? And I know in my own community we had done some of that work, and often we found that family support was a critical component. And it may have been, you know, a father, a mother, or two, or a brother, or a sister. That was a critical part. Another critical piece was knowing that there was some place to go, knowing that they could go and speak to people about common issues and sharing them, and knowing that something would be done about it. And where that was lacking, people were often much more quickly to unhook from the system. What we also find is that it's the young men who are dropping out of post-secondary education at the highest. Young women, for the most part, will remain. And even we have found young women who have dependents on children will usually stick it out, but it's young men. Young men who are ending up back in the communities often, or in the urban center on the streets, with no trades, no real formal education, frustrated like hell at life in the world and seeing all these big promises of funding, but never seeing it as being meaningful to them, meaningful that it's going to make a difference. If you look at Quebec, and I'll use that as an example, the very high suicide rate in some of our communities is just unacceptable. How we tolerate it as First Nations people, how we tolerate it as a society, is damn questionable. Because it would not be allowed anywhere else. And I know when I speak to the Atikamekw, one of the nations in Quebec, about that, and I say, how do you manage every day to get up in the morning to hear that, you know, this 20-year-old with full of promise, full of opportunity, that it's usually a young man that's committed suicide. And the young man answered me, and he said, look, what else are we to do? Cry? Get angry? It happens every month. In some communities, it's every month or every couple of weeks. So you draw a wall, you close it off, and it goes on, and it's kind of a silence over it. Nobody really talks about it, but it goes on. And the young people in these communities, and there are many, many young people, very young population, are seeing this as models. Is there hope? Where is the hope? In the isolated communities, where is the hope? Where do I go? And I'm seeing this all around me. I'm seeing my own people who I taught a lot of promise give up on life. Or, of course, there's the issue of alcohol and violence. In many communities that I speak to from across Canada, and it's you wonder how they're functioning. You're really wondering. I've spoken to women across Canada in the educational field and about their schools, and sometimes how their own elected leadership lets them down and doesn't want to address what appears to be some of the real issues. And one example that comes to mind for me is, it was just a few years ago where there was a school in Manitoba which was built, I guess, in a swampy area, and it got infested with snakes. So in the winter, of course, the snakes are trying to get out of the coal or something, so they're getting into the school and getting behind the heaters. So as the heat got turned up, the snakes were in the classrooms and whatnot, and a few kids have been bit by the snakes. A young lady working in the school went on APTN and said, there's a problem with this. And the next day on APTN, we were told from the news, from what I heard, she got fired. Indian Affairs wouldn't take the responsibility. The band said they weren't responsible. But nobody worried about the kids. Nobody worried about the children, their families, and how terrifying this must have done. And as I met people from Manitoba, I said, I know what my answer would have been. I would have torched the damn place down. I mean, thrown in jail after, but the safety of young people has to come first. And if nobody's going to do anything about it, torch. And we'll see what happens. And sometimes that's what we need to do on some of these issues, be it education or social or health, unless we're really proactive and we really have our voices heard. Because we can walk around with our heads down and pretend that these things are not happening to our people in the urban or the reserve setting. And that's easy. We can do tons of research to back up what we're doing. And in education, you know, I just brought some reports, tons of reports that have been done, you know, that come to validate all the way back to 73. The red paper, some of you may have heard of a Citizens Plus background, McPherson reports, there's audit reports, the Auditor General of Canada, Minister's report. I was told there were 6,000 studies in education that come to explain what the issues are. That First Nations education can only be developed if it's developing a cornerstone of language and culture. And to negate that issue means that the system will not be strong. And it's not to say that we're returning back to the bush, that you're forfeiting what modern society can give, the technology. No. It's the incorporation of all of those things. In Canada, as you probably know, First Nations languages are dying. There are 52 languages about, 11 linguistic groups. Most communities in southern Canada, languages are either totally disappeared or they're on life support. Our identity often as First Nations people is tied to the language, and then the language is tied to the land. By ensuring that First Nations would lose the language meant that we were going to leave the land, and if we left the land, which a lot of us have done, it meant the forestry companies, the mining companies could exploit because we were no longer there. And I know in our own community, when we speak about comprehensive land claims, we are often told, are you still occupying the land? Are you still there? And we're saying, well, no, not really. We go on, but not like we used to. So the courts are saying, well, maybe you still don't retain the same kind of ownership that you once did. So back last spring, there were two national roundtables on education. One dealt with K-12 and the other one dealt with post-secondary. At each of those round tables, and by the way, there were very few students or young people, like all of us, it seems. But at both of those tables, the point was made very clear: language and culture needed to be the cornerstone of the development of any quality education, and education can only be developed by having First Nations in control of what's going on. We all strongly believe from across Canada that we had the capacity, that we had numerous young people who are going through the post-secondary system that would bring the capacity back within our own institutions, within our own communities to take over. And to believe even ourselves that we weren't capable of doing that was for us telling us that maybe we continue to have this colonized mentality that we couldn't do it for ourselves, that we didn't have the capacity. I have always been convinced from a very long time that we do. You know, when I first started to work back in 73, and we used to have to deal with Indian Affairs, and Indian Affairs used to always tell us, you know, that we weren't capable of doing it, that we needed their permission to do this or to do that. If we always believed that we needed somebody else's permission, then we would never move. As I say, we may as well then put our heads down and say, well, that's too bad. You know what? It could be worse, is what they're going to say. And I say, that is not acceptable. And I keep hoping that people who are ending up in the communities or in government jobs with their First Nations or not. They're going to stand up and feel good about themselves and make a difference. Because our people are suffering. I mean, if you're from a community, you know what it is, you know what some of the issues are. I'm sure you have your own thoughts about the dynamics of a community, the political dynamics, the family dynamics that come into play as to what's going to occur in those communities. And it can be very challenging. It is very challenging. The pain, I guess, that a lot of young people are facing, you know, I've been to a lot of schools. I chose a lot of schools. I guess that a lot of young people are facing, you know, I've been to a lot of schools and you know, the children arrive at the school or they're in a recreation facility, and especially as they're very young and they have all of this hope. Where do they lose it? At what point do they start to unconnect and really they're beginning to drop out of school from that point on, where they're giving up and they're saying, I don't give a shit. Who cares? Let's vandalize. Let's paint the walls. Let's break the windows. And you give up on your own community. Again, I view it as giving up that there's hope. And a week ago, as many of you, I'm sure, heard on the news, I mean, there was this very high-level meeting in Kelowna, first minister's meeting, federal government, Aboriginal organizations, provincial governments. And this had been in the works for over 2 years in preparation. First Nations people, chiefs, and others, certainly from Quebec, were in many ways left out of the high-level discussions. And as you may or may not know, the Quebec chiefs opted not to participate in the Kelowna meeting. All of the chiefs of Quebec, including the Crees and the Anishinaabe, which was the first, because they did not feel that the direction being taken and the announcements being made would be in line to the direction that they viewed it should be. The whole meeting did not deal with a rights issue. It dealt with a program issue. So the idea was, if we pump in more money into these programs, it's going to make a difference. There is about $5 billion over 5 years announced. $1.8 billion for education, including First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. As we began to analyze the $1.8 million and what it meant, we began to realize that some of this is just recycled money. Old money with a new name. So it wasn't new money being put in for the K-12, and now there's a non-reserve component of $150 million. And that's where the provincial governments said, we're happy, because they saw this as an opportunity to access money for their own education system to be doing a job that they should be doing in the first place. In post-secondary education, we see $500 million over 5 years. At first we say, hey, that sounds good. It's going to help alleviate the shortfall there is in post-secondary. But in reality, this money had already been approved even before the first minister's meeting. It's something called Bill C-48. Jack Layton, who was trying to hold up the Liberal Party, had negotiated a deal, and part of that deal was issues around health and post-secondary. And in the post-secondary, amount of money that was set aside over 2 years by government was a component for First Nations. But at the First Minister's meeting, they put this in to make it look like it's new money. And it doesn't. So the question becomes, of course, the whole review being done on post-secondary, where all aspects of the post-secondary program, and if you're not familiar with the program allows funding to the community level to fund students at a post-secondary level to pay for their tuition, their books, their allowance, whatnot, to be able to access post-secondary level studies. And the study now is being put on hold because we're unsure whether or not this is it, that there won't be a new program, same old program with a few more dollars to it. What we do know is that there's a tremendous need. And there's a tremendous need in the skills area for development there. A lot of our young men who don't want to go on to college and university do want to take training, and there's a tremendous need at the community level and in the urban center, because it doesn't matter where you should be able to go and work in the trades area, but that is not occurring. There are all kinds of limitations. Education in Canada has really come a long way in 25 years. For some of you who are not familiar with it, Indian control of Indian education policy, back in 1973, Jean Chrétien is Minister of Indian Affairs. He accepts the policy, which really lays the framework for First Nations to take control of their education. But the federal government had seen at that time, though, was that we would mimic the provincial education system, that we would be photocopy that. But First Nations saw it differently. We saw the opportunity to develop a system that was more responsive to what we thought our needs were. Breaking away from the mold of residential schools, because a lot of the parents who were discussing this were the products of residential schools. And if not the product of residential schools, and the product of integrated schools. Because in the 50s, the idea was to integrate First Nations into the provincial system. You know, with the idea of assimilation and termination. Because the more assimilated you became, the more you lost your language, the more you became like them, the less you would be tied to your culture and language and want to maintain that tie to the land again. And that whole attempt. And that's why it was really, I guess, a bit upsetting that the whole rights issue and territorial issue is not being addressed. Because without the territory to be able to give ourselves our own economic development base, our own resources, our communities are going to continue to be very dependent on government, something we don't want to be. First Nations don't want to have to be dependent. I mean, it's a lot more pride in being able to work and, you know, help your family and put things on the table. But that opportunity is not being created, and the problems continue. There's no doubt that in the $5 billion, you know, they deal with housing, and we've all heard about housing in First Nations communities, and also in urban centers and health. The $700 million, I believe, that was announced last year on health, $100 million of which was going to be used for training additional nurses and other health practitioners, has not flowed at all. It's gone nowhere. And all of the data that we see in presentations made by Indian Affairs to the Auditor General of Canada, and she's addressed a number of things, there seems to be a shift now on their part to try to make it look like that the full blame rests on First Nations people, that they're doing their job and they're doing it well, and that we're the ones not doing our job, and that we should be accountable, and that if it's not happening, it's because we're not prepared to engage in this process. And in Quebec, again, the chiefs have made it very clear, we will not engage in a process that's going to kind of forfeit our rights that we believe we've all held. We're not going to do that. We will not allow the federal government to offload to the province their responsibility, what is called a fiduciary responsibility. But for us, it's much more than that, much more than that, for having taken our lands. And I know in other presentations where I've gone, some people say, well, you know, you're always kind of crying, there's not enough money, you want more. And my point to people is this. You know what, I'm ready to make a deal. If I have that power to make a deal, you know, will the $8 or $9 billion that is presently spent for First Nations, by Indian Affairs, Health Canada and whatnot, keep it all. You can keep it all. But you know what? Give us back our land. We'll do a trade-off. If you give us back our land, you can keep the money. But if you don't give us back our land, you got to keep the money flowing. It's a trade-off, because for us, I mean, with all that's occurring with forestry in the Quebec territory, I use that again as an example, but and the clear-cutting that's going on, are people not able to go into those territories to go and pick their medicines, their traditional medicines, to do traditional practices, is going to impact on all of us. It's impacting on all of us now. And I know there's discussion in Quebec, and we may not care about it now, because we might find that our lifestyle is okay, and we read the newspaper and we get angry, but it's going to have an impact on all of society. I mean, we hear global warming and other things that are occurring. How long are we prepared to allow it to happen? How long are we prepared as First Nations people or people in general to say that we're okay, that we've now heard that there's five young people who committed suicide, or you know, there's violence in the communities? How long? And what are we prepared to do about it? As individuals, what are we prepared to do about it other than just talk about it? And it's my belief that it's by individuals, young people, stepping up to the plate, taking on leadership roles, and trying to make a difference. And we know that in Canada, the leadership positions, band councils in particular, are held primarily by men. I sat in the band council off and on, as I mentioned, over the years. And I remember how the women who came in, because we were all men sitting around the table, how the women were so intimidated to the point of shaking and crying. And well, I'd be shaking and crying too. Right? You have, you know, 5 or 10 men around the table, and they're all sitting back. So what do you want today? You know, and here you have a young person of 20, and they have 1 or 2 children, and you know, they're looking for something better in their lives, training, better house, and here you have men who are saying, "Oh, pull up your socks, take care of yourself." And unless we're able, I believe anyhow, that's my belief, unless we're able to find balance within our elected councils, within the communities, and then it goes all the way up to regional and then to national. To what extent, ask yourself this question, within the Assembly of First Nations, are the women voices heard so that it makes a difference in the decisions that were made here? Did they offend, agree to this? I wouldn't be able to answer you. And if you went to any community and say, "What's your thoughts on this?" they would say, What are you talking about? What announcements? People are not aware of this or what it means. But if you tell them, they're going to say, "Well, how is that going to impact me tomorrow? What difference will that make in my life tomorrow? I've got 2, 3, 4, or 5 kids to raise. My house has mold in it. I'm trying to do the best I can. Trying to do the best I can to prepare my children for a better life, but there doesn't seem to be any sometimes." I spoke a little bit about the issue of the languages. Canadian Heritage a few years ago announced that it was going to put aside $160 million. It started off by $172 million for the preservation and enhancement of First Nations languages in Canada. Eventually, some of that money whittled away, and then they put in place a task force that looked into how this money could be spent. Now, it may seem like a lot of money, but when we did the math on it, we take that kind of money for Métis, Inuit, and First Nations. I know a community like mine with a population of 15 on reserve would get about $20,000. Now, the $20,000 is supposed to come and help ensure the survival of the language. We did a study of what kind of money is spent in Ontario, for example, or by the federal government for the French language. It's humongous amounts. The task force produced a report called Towards a New Beginning, 26 or 28 recommendations. A new institution is going to be created to flow the money. My question always is, whenever you're creating all of these layers, you're creating many filters that don't get to the people, whether on reserve or in the urban center. It looks good on paper, beautiful reports. There are a lot of nice things. But what does it mean for the people? And then we wonder why the results at the end of the day aren't what we're looking for. And the people at the community level often haven't been involved. So somebody arrives and says, we have a package for you, and this is the way you're going to have to do it. And these are the results you're supposed to get. And if you don't get these results, it means that you're not meeting to our expectation. And right now in education, to the point that performance indicators, outcomes, will determine how funding is going to flow and the kind of accountability being required. The Auditor General indicated time and time again that First Nations there are so many reports required out of First Nations for programs that you can't believe it. In education, there's tons, constantly reporting, duplication. She's told Indian Affairs, you better change your way of looking at things to ensure that there is a streamlining of reports. I go back to say that unless people, and someone was recently telling me that back in the days, in the 70s, late 60s, with the white paper, and in 69, when the white paper that Jan Chrétien tried to put forward, there was this mass movement in Canada by First Nations. But it was also a period of revival, red power, feeling strong, you know, feeling good about who you were in the urban centers and on the reserve, and there was this movement, a revolution took place on the part of First Nations. But now what we're seeing and hearing is that we're becoming complacent. We seem to try to want to analyze many things. We're not as prepared to take action, and we just accept it for what it is. And as many people that I've met have said, you know what, it could be worse. It could be worse. So why should we struggle to have any more? Because it could be worse. I don't think it can be worse in some of the communities that I see. You look at pictures of young children and you wonder, and we all see them, and say, what life is in store? Who at the end of the day will care that she commits suicide? I hope we all do. I really hope that we all do, and that it makes a difference. And I know in all the discussions, there is no simple answer. In my own community, as I see across Canada, that the diabetes issue, obesity issue, violence issue, there's no quick fix to that. The fix rests with the people themselves. And I believe it starts by giving people hope, by giving people, young people hope, children hope, and supporting them. And building on success. And allowing communities to develop programs and activities or approaches that belong to them. the fight that takes place nationally in regards to who should be responsible for First Nations people living in urban centers is one also that has to come to an end. You know, the people living in urban centers are caught in between. Is it their band council? Is it the Congress of Aboriginal People? Is it the Friendship Centers? And it appears sometimes that each of these organizations are out to claim that they are responsible because there'll be funding attached to it. But as you well know, I mean, since a few years now, First Nations people living in urban centers are allowed to vote, right, for their band councils, which has thrown a whole new dynamics into who might get elected on band council, although you still have to be a resident of the reserve in order to be nominated and elected to band council. But if you're a chief, you don't even have to be a First Nations person. First of all, you can be anybody. Because I'm told out west, one of the communities were so upset into the changes because they wanted to have their own electoral code and whatnot, and they decided to nominate Nelson Mandela. And the way it works is that as long as two people nominate the person has to officially decline, otherwise the name stays on the ballot. Which was really ironic, and I'm not sure what the outcome was of that. And even if you're not present for a nomination, your name will stand on the ballot. But that's the whole issue of the Indian Act and what it means. But it goes to show you, though, that even the people, First Nations people living in urban centers, I mean, both have a responsibility, I hope, to make sure that the people that are being elected at the community level, because their decisions are going to impact on them regardless. And issues of health issues and what's going on, issues of territory and resources that have come later. And I think often there's not enough accountability on the part of band councils in regards to people living in urban centers. And it's only recent that they become a bit more interested. Why? Because there are votes tied to it. So if I go speak to them, you know, they'll vote for me and they'll feel that I'm interested and whatnot.